Welcome to Philly Prime. I'm Dave Schrattweiser, and this week on the program, we're going to talk about the Philly Mob. We haven't talked about him in a while, and we're going to bring on somebody who knows his way around mob circles, former Lucchese crime family soldier John Panisi, government cooperator and podcaster and blogger. I'm sure most of you know him who follow the kind of mob circles, at least on podcasts and things like that. John's really cut a path for himself doing that. John, welcome to the show. We appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks for having me.
All right. And some people are going to be like, well, why are you bringing on a New York, former New York wise guy to talk about the Philly mob? Well, John knows his way around Philadelphia a little bit and got invited into the inner sanctum at least one time. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But John, as a former wise guy, I want to ask you kind of what you think about the Philly case that's just about wrapped up now. And let me summarize. 15 people were indicted in November 2020 on racketeering, conspiracy, and other charges, several of them on drugs. All of them, 14 out of 15, had pled guilty. One defendant had passed away. The biggest names, Steve Mazzone, former underboss, Dominic Grandi, a capo in the family, and Sonny Mazzone, also Joseph Servideo, a soldier in the family. Everybody's pled out.
Yep.
All of the sentencings are over except Steve Mazzone, which will occur in 2 weeks now. It was put off a couple of weeks ago after his attorney, John Maringolo, passed away. So just to set the stage there. But, John, I'm curious your impressions of that case. You've been on the witness stand a couple of times. You know your way around a government case. Just your thoughts.
I mean, the case in itself hurt them. You got Steve Mazzone taken out. He was, I think, an alleged underboss. And you have one of their top captains, Dom Grandi.
Yeah, and you met both of those individuals before. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But a blow like this to the family when you lose essentially an entire wing of the family, the Mazzone wing, and several others who were in under him, kind of what does that do to the family as a whole? And then maybe tell us, how do you put the pieces back together after those guys go off to prison, which they all will do, I'm told, starting in January?
Yeah, well, a family never wants to take a hit like that. And when they do, he lost, as I said, meaning Joey Molino lost an underboss and he lost one of his top captains. So now he has to make a decision. What is he going to do? Is he going to fill these positions? And how's he going to go about that? And we could talk a little bit about that. I know you wanted to speak about that.
Yeah, tell me, how does that work? I mean, does somebody normally who was under either Mazzone and or Grandi kind of indicate who they want? Is this, in this case, the alleged boss, Joey Merlino, is this his choice? It is a conglomeration of opinions here. And in some cases, I think you and I talked about this on the phone, they could put no one in those positions.
Yeah, he could just do – I'm sorry, some window's coming up right now. He could just, meaning Joey Molino could just leave it alone. He could do whatever he wants. As the boss of the family, he could just leave it alone, not fill these positions. And, or he could start with, the easiest position to fill is the captain position. I don't know if they do the same thing in Philly that they do in a lot of the New York families where they have an acting captain. They should. So in that situation, the acting captain would usually get bumped up and take over the crew. If there's not an acting captain, then they could pick someone in the crew to become the captain or the acting captain. He could put somebody else and bump them up and make them a captain. I mean, there's a lot he could do with that. Mm-hmm. Mazzone's position is a harder one to fill, you know, and he may want to either make the decision on his own to put somebody there or maybe confer with his administration. You know, he has an administration and somebody may step into the position as an acting or, you know, maybe they'll create a panel, you know, like the New York families, he may create a panel if they don't have one in place already. They may have a panel and they just won't fill it.
You've met Merlino a couple times. You know him. Does he consult with former boss, acting boss Joe Legambi, who's now sort of a consigliere? Does he consult with John Shanglini, who's a capo? Does he consult with George Borghese, another high-ranking member in the family? Do they sit down and talk about this? Do they not sit down and talk about it? kind of how does that work?
I mean, the definitive answer, I wouldn't know exactly what he's doing, but I mean, he should sit with his administration, or Joey being Joey, he could just do it, you know, whatever way he wants. You know, mm-hmm. That's his personality. Yeah. But if the right move would be probably to talk with Lagambi and the rest of these guys, Changalini, Johnny Chang, and go over what's the best option for that.
Yeah.
You know, to move, to put somebody in that position or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, we all know the money stream in the mob these days, especially here in Philadelphia, is kind of dried up, or it's at its low ebb here. This is a big chunk of money that moved through the family, if you believe the government documents on this case. Kind of, how do you replace that? And I guess you got to replace that quickly, right?
If you can, you know, a lot of these guys, as we say, was chasing the same dollar. You know, it's not easy.
Yeah. Let me ask you about, people are kind of wondering probably, how does John know the folks in the Philly mob? And maybe you can walk us back through this. You actually took a trip here to Philadelphia.
I met Joey Molino through Joe Perno, who was a member of our crew. And he had come, Joe Perno originally, all the Pernas originally were part of the Jersey faction of the Lucchese family. We originally got Ralphie and Johnny was put in our crew. Then they sent them back. And it was funny because they it was like a punishment. Like, to come to the Brooklyn faction, you were getting punished. So first we got Ralphie, which is the father, and Johnny. And then they sent them back. And then we got Joe Perna. And what was happening was there was a lot of internal fighting inside the Jersey faction within the Pernas. I believe, I don't know if the Tassettas were involved, but there was a lot of in-house fighting, so they separated them. And when Joe Perna came to our crew, I became friendly with him and we got close. He eventually introduces me to Joey Molino, and we one day took a trip out to Philly. And we first went to Ray Wagg's house, who's always in pictures with Joey. And then Joey and I left, and we went to a diner in Philly. I spoke to you about the diner. I don't know the name, but they hang out in this diner. The first guy we ran into was Johnny Chang. Joey introduced me to him. I had a message from Joey Amato. Joey Amato is a captain with the Colombo family. I had spoken to him prior to me going to Philly. He said, do me a favor, if you see Johnny Chang, give him a message for me. And I relayed the message to Johnny Chang. Then Joey and I went and met up with Dom, Stevie Mazzone, Stevie's brother Sonny. I don't believe anyone else was there at that time. And we had a late breakfast with them.
Yeah.
Afterwards, we went to their club, which was like on a corner of it's on a corner somewhere in South Philly, but it was a bar kind of social club.
Yeah.
We met back
at the time. At the time, I think that's 11th and Jackson. We're probably talking about, it's across from a church.
Yeah. And that not, day,
another one too, that was up and running at that time.
On that day, something was going on with some motorcycle bikers or something. They had like a big, I don't know, had the street closed on the main avenue up ahead, and we had to go in the blocks to get there. Mm-hmm. But we met back up with Mazzone and Dom and Sonny, and there was a couple other guys. I don't remember exactly who I met. You know, they were introducing me to different people. I don't know if they were just guys from the neighborhood or part of their crew or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But what I took away after meeting, by the way, Joey Molino wasn't there that day in Philly. He was
The Joey you're talking about is Joe Perna, correct?
Yeah, Joe Perna.
Yeah.
So Joey Molino, when I went down to Philly, wasn't there. His guys were there. And what I took away from that was that you could tell they were obviously, you know, childhood friends. They were very, very close. They were very different from New York guys. You know, I'm from New York, and I grew up around New York guys. So they were very, very different from the way guys in that life in New York act. I can't describe it, but they were different.
Yeah. Let's do me a quick favor. Give me a little thumbnail impression from a mobster point of view. Steve Mazzone, what were your thoughts about him when you met him?
Reserved. He definitely, you know, he held his position. You could tell he was a guy that had a position. You know, he knew how to act. They all knew how to act. You know, there was nobody acted out of, you know, out of place. But Dom was young. Dom, you know, he was young guy to be a captain at the time. I think they might have just made him a captain at that time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He was introduced as a captain to me. Nice guy. They were all nice guys. You know, mm-hmm. There was nothing that they did disrespectful or anything like that.
Yeah.
But Stevie definitely, you could tell he was seasoned. You know, he'd been around a block and he'd been around a life. You could tell.
Yeah. And Dom, your impressions of him, you know, there's a lot of people I've always kind of questioned his quick kind of mercurial rise in the family. He's moved up pretty quickly at a young age. I think there were some who kind of envisioned him possibly as down the road 10 or 15 years from now as being a potential boss in the family. What was your thoughts about his makeup and the way he carried himself?
He carried himself well. You know, he was, again, they were all very respectful. Mm-hmm. You know, don't forget, we were brothers in that life, you know, back then when I was in the life at the time. They were very respectful. You know, they opened up their doors to me and Joey Perna as well. Dom was young, you know, but we were all young at that time. But he was a young guy for that position. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wasn't around him enough to really get a good impression of him. I mean, he seemed to carry himself well.
Yeah, yeah. So when you now step back 5 years later, I think, since that trip,
yeah.
And you see these guys are now going to go off to jail in January. You can see why this is a big loss for the crew and why you probably have to put people in those positions to keep moving.
I think that, you know, I know that Dom was kind of like a centerpiece to this indictment. And you can't be in that life. You can't be greedy, because if you're greedy, you go into jail. That's the law, right? That's the bottom line. That's the way it always goes. Anybody that got greedy went away. And, you know, from what I know a little bit that I do know about the indictment, you know, there's greed in the background of that. And that was their downfall. So I don't know if it was because he is a young captain and he got caught up like this and Stevie got snared into it. You know, I don't know, but it just seems that way.
Yeah. The sentences for Dom looks like it's 78 months for him. Steve is looking at 45 to 60. The government wants 60 months. His lawyers argued for 45. They made a big point about talking about he has moved into his mom's house. He's been helping take care of his mom along with his brother, Sonny. They've stressed his family ties. They talked about him working. They actually said his plan is to secure permanent employment, which he apparently already has when he gets out of prison, and to leave Philadelphia after 60 years living here and to start a new life. That's right in the paperwork from Steve's lawyers that the sentencing is coming up in a couple of weeks. But your thoughts about that?
Well, first of all, that all sounds good. You know, but I as far as the plea, you know, they definitely threw a number at him that he accepted. And I think that whatever that is, do you know what the number is? They should be around that area. They shouldn't be giving him no upward departure.
No, it doesn't sound like there's a possibility for that, although I don't think you can rule that out. I think the deal might go away if that were to happen. But right now, the government's asking for the high end, the 60 months. Yeah. His lawyers are asking for the low end, 45.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, he's jammed up at, is he 60? I think he's in his 60s or 60?
He's 59. He might be turning 60 pretty soon.
Okay, so he's 60 years old going to the can. You know, even at 40-something months, those are years that you don't get back. Whether he is going to come out and move out of Philly and go get himself a job, he'd be smart to, but you know, that's just the name. That's the game.
And I'm assuming you agree kind of with mostly everybody out there that the induction ceremony caught on tape, in which Steve is a very prominent speaker throughout that ceremony, would give you good cause to consider a guilty plea as opposed to going to trial and taking this to a jury, which could have got him a much bigger sentence, considering that he did 9 years already for racketeering from 2000 to 2009.
Absolutely, because the tape proves racketeering right there. You know, that's, you're guilty on the racketeering right there. Even though it's not, so a lot of people don't know this. And on the other side, in Italy and Sicily, it's a crime. Like, they can't, an induction ceremony could get you time. You know, it's mafia association. Over here, it's not.
Right.
It's not a crime to be inducted into a family.
Yeah.
But the act of doing it when you're on a RICO case proves RICO. You know, it's a little tricky.
And some of his comments in there about, you know, the money you make isn't your money.
Yeah.
It comes here. This is where it comes. We decide where the money goes. That was pretty damning, I think, for Steve. There's some other comments about taking back Atlantic City. We don't want anybody glomming our shit, taking our, what's ours.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's also introductions made during that induction ceremony
based
on the transcripts that I've seen. You know, everybody gets introduced, and that's never good when that's on tape.
Well, that's not, I mean, it's a must during the induction ceremony because that's a guy's first introductions, but it, you know, to have it on tape is bad. It's just bad that they could always use that tape.
Yeah. And you've been in an FBI debriefing room, I'm sure, and seen charts that they like to make up. That induction ceremony pretty much solidifies whatever chart they're making or moves the pieces around a little bit, but helps them make that chart, correct?
Well, you're correct. But what, as far as seeing charts, it's funny. I just had this conversation with a few people who were on a Zoom call. Believe it or not, any time that I had to go into the FBI office, they would cover the charts. Mm. They would cover them. Even though I was there, they covered them. They didn't even want me to see their charts.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that is because they don't want you to see where they have people positioned. A, they want to hear from you where you think they're positioned.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the reasoning behind it, but they, and I always looked. Mm-hmm. Like, I've seen, I knew, you could tell it was the charts.
Yeah.
I always looked. And every time I went in, I looked and it was covered. So I don't know specifically what the reason was. It's probably something to do with that, you know, if I'm looking, maybe they want to ask me about something and then I would have already seen it.
Yeah.
Just like if they showed me a picture, they would, if there was a name there, they would cover the name.
Yeah.
They wouldn't let me see the name.
Yeah.
And, you know, do you know this person? Yeah, that's so-and-so. And then they would take the hand away, like they would cover it, or they would move the computer.
Yeah.
You know, so it's probably, you're probably right about that. But I've never seen one shot.
Okay. Dom is also on that tape pretty heavily talking. Steve's explaining who his crew is and who's in his crew. Also, I'm sure a contributing factor for Dom Grandy on deciding to plead guilty, in addition to tapes about him involved in drug activity with Joe Servideo and others, a government informant.
Yeah, well, you know, one, you want to take a, if you could get a plea and it's in your range, what you're comfortable with, you want to take that plea and run with it. But two, if there's damaging tapes and you're on those tapes, you'd want to get out of that case quickly. You wouldn't want that, you don't want those tapes playing to a jury and then they're going to be putting them all over the news and everything else. So you want to get out of that. So tapes have a lot to do with probably the plea.
Yeah. And George Anastasia, my partner on Mob Talk, likes to say you can't cross-examine a tape.
No.
And it's difficult. Once it's out there and it's heard by the jury, it's tough to get around that.
Your voice, you know, as everybody knows, what convicted John Gotti?
Mm.
It was the tapes.
Yeah.
The tapes are damaging. Yeah. Tapes are.
Let me ask a question. This trip down to Philadelphia with Joe Perna, would you describe it as kind of like an eye-opener? Is that unusual for guys in one family to travel down to this, another city and meet with the higher echelon of another organized crime family? What are you thinking as you're driving down the turnpike with Joe Perna? And then I want to ask you about the trip coming back.
No, we it was social. We weren't doing business. We were just going there. And then, you know, sometimes, don't forget, I've met their boss, right? So I've met Joey. And, you know, now you sometimes you would meet their crew. Sometimes, you know, I met Joe Camarano, who was the boss of the acting boss of the Bonanno family. And then sometimes you'll meet people under them. It's just, it's even though Joe Camarano, we were all in New York, but I met Joey a few times. You know, we went to dinner and I met him at Joey's house for the first time. And, you know, so that's just meeting his Bugatti.
Yes.
It wasn't no business. We were just going socially for introductions. That was
courtesy type thing.
Within
the mob.
Yeah. I mean, you know, these guys all pal around with one another. You know, there's a lot of meeting going on, a lot of introducing going on. It happens all the time. It's just so happens to be that they were from Philly and we were New York guys.
Yeah.
Well, as far as our crew, Joey was a Jersey guy.
All right. So this big, long day in Philly for you and then back in the car and back up to New York or North Jersey. I know there were a lot of specifics talked in there, and I'm not asking you to talk about the specifics if you don't feel that's appropriate.
Yeah.
But in general, that was quite a ride home from.
Well, I mean, it's a trip both ways. It's a trip. Joe Perna drove.
Yeah.
And he did ask me, like, how I felt about Don.
Yeah.
You know, he said originally, how do you, you know, what would you think of these guys? And I explained that they would, it's hard to explain how different they were. They were just different than New York guys, obviously, because they come from Philly and we're from New York.
And, you know, and it's because they're all boyhood friends too, John. Is that maybe part of it?
That's that a definite that the closeness you could tell. Like we didn't have that as far as the crew that I was with. I didn't grow up with these guys, so I didn't have that closeness. I seen similar closeness because some of these guys in Brooklyn did grow up with each other. I didn't. I grew up in Ozone Park and Howard Beach, but they had a very, very strong bond. That's without a doubt. But I didn't have anything bad to say about any of them. I just, as they probably thought that we were different, you know, I thought that they were different because they're from Philly and we're not.
Yeah.
But he asked me about Dom. I, you know, I said he was a nice guy and that he was young, you know, for that position. I could tell he just got the position. And I believe he did. I think according to what we know.
Yeah. Question. You know, this kind of thing, you know, you see these guys and you're around the guys and things like that, and you know that they're friends. Dom is younger than the main crew, but five or six of these guys grew up in the same neighborhood, down the block from each other, hung out on the same corner together, played half ball and stick ball and whatnot together, went to school together. The amount of time they went to school, that kind of stuff. So a lot of people, including themselves, have told me that that bond is going to be almost impossible to break for federal prosecutors, that nobody in that circle, because they're not only mob guys, but they are, you know, lifelong friends, that breaking that chain would be next to impossible. Your thoughts about that?
I agree wholeheartedly that that particular crew of guys, you're not breaking it. No way.
You would need
it. Want to know why?
Go ahead.
He is one better. They are not. Not only are you not breaking them, not only is the FBI not breaking them, they're not turning on one another. Forget about the mob. They're friends first. So that comes first. That's more important. If your foundation of a relationship, their friendship, comes before the mob to them. And that's, you could tell. They also were kidding around. They like to kid around. And like New York guys, they like to, as they say, bust balls. They like to kid around. And they were teasing about Joey Molino and teasing other people in their crew as well. I think I mentioned, I'm not going to get into it, but they were naming, nicknaming people and, you know, they liked to pal around and kid around a lot. So they, it wasn't a serious get together at all. They were all kidding around. It was mostly a lot of laughs.
Yeah, I got to tell you, from my watching the mob in Philadelphia for over three decades, it appears to me that sometimes these clubhouses that they get together in are not for any kind of mob activity. It's like to hang around with each other, like to play cards.
Yeah, it's
like
not
to drink. And there's been bugs in mob clubhouses in Philadelphia before, but I'm not aware of any really good tape that came out of a mob clubhouse. I think they just like to hang around
because they're pals. You have guys.
And they'll tell you that. Yeah.
No, you have guys like Mazzone and Cangolini and these guys that are seasoned. They know better. They're not gonna have incriminating conversations in their club. That's a given. So there's a lot of people think that they're in there and they're up to something, and they're not. They're just hanging around, either eating. Mostly guys are cooking and eating and drinking.
And you've done that yourself, correct?
Yeah. We used to go to the club in the Bronx, the Lucchese Club. Food was on my mind because food was always on the menu. Whether one of the captains, Richie DeLuca, was cooking, or they had food sent in. They always had food ordered in. We were always eating something there, and it was good food. And that's what they do. And a lot of people don't know that. It's just guys hanging around that are part of the same, you know, Bogota, but they're just hanging around. They're not. You know, it doesn't mean that something nefarious is going on.
Yeah, I mentioned just on the recent mob talk that we videoed with George Anastasia that currently the clubhouse that they were in on 9th Street, just outside the Italian Market area of Philadelphia, there's a for rent sign up on the door, and nobody's hanging out there now.
Yeah,
is that a sign that things are bad, or is it just time to move on?
I mean, they may be moving on. They may be saying, you know what, we're gonna. No more clubs, you know. New York did it. The Bronx Social Club that I mentioned, the Lucchese Club was gone.
Yeah. And listen, go ahead.
They had inside their, I believe it was a social club. It would look like a corner bar.
Yeah.
But there were so many people sending drinks that we couldn't drink. You know, they line them up with the shot glass. They were lining them up in this place with the shot glasses. It was impossible for us to drink all those drinks.
Yeah. You know? They were definitely showing you guys a good time, Joe Perna and yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it was very, very laid back. And it was strictly social, nothing more. It was not about business between New York and Philly, although some of that goes on, but that was not what this trip was about at all.
Yeah. Let's talk about being around Joey. You had at least, from what I know from talking to you, two occasions to be in his company.
A couple, yeah.
In New York, your impressions of him from being around?
Very different from any of the New York bosses that I met. You know, extremely different. But more in a down to earth way. You know, Joey is just like Joey is a guy that smokes cigarettes all day and drinks beer after beer after beer. And can probably drink just about anybody that I know under the table. Mm. Yeah.
And he likes a good time, correct?
Yes. I what struck me the most was that he, with the Instagram thing, like I was kind of shocked over that. I didn't know that he had Instagram and he was on Instagram, and that shocked me.
Mm. Yeah. That really shocked. The times in New York, they were at restaurants, correct? Other guys were present. He was introduced to you, if I understand correctly. Different guys are at the table, that kind of thing. Definitely.
Yeah, we
had
a position
of power in wherever you were.
We were in. They came to meet me one night in a restaurant at Howard Beach, Mateo's, which is a Gambino spot. And that night, besides Joe Perna and Joe Molino came, I was there with Blaze Carrazzo. Blaze Carrazzo is a member of the Gambino family. And who was it? Joe Cafe. which was a captain in our family, Lucchese's, was having dinner with some guys, and I don't remember who was at his table, and he had come over and joined us, so we had to introduce Blaze and Joe Cafe to Joey Molino. But it was, once again, it was, there was no business. It was just strictly social. And then we went out for to a bar after that for drinks.
Yeah. What's the respect factor for Joey in New York when he's around guys from other families, at least when you were with him?
It's, you know, it's they're going to respect him as another friend. There's, you know, a lot of guys, and people don't understand this, a lot of people don't recognize him as the boss, even though he was or is, because there was a lot of things that took place in the past. But a lot of guys, for whatever reason, you know, they'll meet him, whether they recognize him as a boss or not, you know, is on them.
Let's shift gears a little bit here for a second. You're a podcaster, John. Now you're blogging. You're doing all kinds of stuff. Sit Down News is your podcast and blog that you do. You have another one as well, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
Talk to me about doing that. It's a much different life than the life you were accustomed to before you went over and began cooperating with the government and you were in the mob. You got inducted in 2013. Am I right about that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were in jail before that for 17 years. You came out, you were 37.
I made my 38th birthday. So I got out in June of 07, and in August was my 38th birthday.
Yeah. Okay. And then, so just kind of what's that life been for you? Like doing the podcast. I know you get a little bit of heat, obviously, in New York.
Yeah.
We all get heat. You know that. Yeah. We're probably going to get heat for this.
Yeah.
But having said all that, your thoughts about the experience of openly talking about organized crime stuff, the mob and individuals in the mob on a podcast, kind of what's that been like for you?
Well, first of all, it was never my intention. You know, this was never my plan and never my intention. What happened, and I think I mentioned it somewhere else, was that someone wrote an article and they got some information that was incorrect. And I emailed the person and I said, you know, you got this wrong. So you're, as a journalist, you got to correct this. This is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, any journalist is going to say, well, why don't you correct it? And, you know, and the guy wrote some articles and whatnot. And as a result of that, that's kind of opened up the door to me going into the podcasting. And, but since then, you know, it's very, very different than the way I lived my life in the past, obviously. And, but I could do what I want, you know, if I want to talk, there's obviously things that I don't talk about. And there's people, there's a lot of things that I don't talk about. And I have the right to choose what I want to talk about and what I don't want to talk about, or who I'll talk about, who I don't want to talk about. There's people that I really don't bring up because I had a closer relationship to them, and maybe I don't want to talk about them or talk about things with them.
Yeah.
But, you know, I know people like to hear things that they never heard before. There's a lot of content on YouTube that's repeated over and over and over again, right? And there's things that even myself that I've covered that's been covered before. If I do that, I try to put a different spin on it or try to find out things that nobody heard before. There's a lot going to be coming up. I can't go into it too much. I discussed it with you. There's going to be a little shift, and there's going to be content that nobody's ever heard before, which I'm very excited about. And I think that a lot of people are going to enjoy, because let's face it, even you and I, if you watch something on TV that you've seen before, you know, you've seen it. If something new comes on, it's something interesting, right?
Yeah.
And I think that on YouTube itself, whenever there's something new, it grabs people's attention. And that's what I try to do, and that's the direction I'm heading in.
Yeah.
The blog is, it's, you know, it's not easy. So I'm not going to call myself a journalist. I'm obviously not a journalist. I'm a blogger, right? And I've even stopped hashtagging journalists because I don't want anybody to think that I think I'm a journalist. I'm not.
Right.
I'm mm-hmm. far from a journalist. I have a lot to learn. My writing is mediocre. You know, I struggle to try and get it right, and I'm sure I make a lot of mistakes. But the reason that I started writing, even before the blog, was therapy. It was more therapeutic for me than anything. And I've written even in prison, like little stories and things. And I kind of enjoy it, but I find it more therapeutic. And that started me. That's what really I started first was writing. It came a long way. You know, it's now a paid subscription. It's doing very well, better than I thought it would.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you and I spoke about that, you do similar things. You're more on a professional level than I am. But I do enjoy it. And sometimes, again, I try to write about things that maybe weren't written about before. And if they were, again, I try to come at it at a different angle and, you know, spin it in a different way. It's, you know,
it's just kind of a liberating thing for you, given being in the life where you're not supposed to talk to anybody. You certainly wouldn't talk to reporters.
No.
You wouldn't talk to police. You wouldn't do
no.
that kind of thing. And now you're kind of enabled here to go out and talk about what you just said. Talk about people you want to talk about.
Look, you know,
events you want to talk about, things like that. That's a lot different than
so,
walking in the shoe steps as a mob soldier.
Yes. So I'm no longer in the life. I mean, that's a given, right? And when you're in the life, you have to, you know, you have to follow certain rules.
Mm-hmm.
You never feel like it is your own life because you have to give your life to your family. You know, that's what it's about. You know, your life is, they come first, right? And believe me when I tell you that your life is not your own, because you're always doing something. Even it doesn't matter. You had to cancel plans. You could be on a date with a girl. You could be at the dinner. You get a call. You got to go. There's no questions asked. You need to go.
Yeah.
You don't have to jump up right that second and leave, depending on what it is. But you have to make your way. You know, people understand. All right. You know, can you get here in 2 hours? You know, finish up what you're doing. But you have to go. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Your life is not your own. So you brought up a very good word. Liberating. And yes, so I'm a civilian now. I'm no longer in that life. I live life as a civilian. And I can talk about, regardless of who don't like it and who likes it and whatnot, that's not for me. That's not why I do it. I don't care who don't like it. And I care who likes it, because those are people who view it.
Uh-huh.
I don't care who don't like it. That's on them.
Uh-huh. If you don't like it, don't listen, right?
Yeah, if you don't like it, don't listen. And, you know, everybody, listen, we all have, everybody has opinions, you know what I mean? And that's just the way life is. You're not going to please everybody. You know that. You're not going to please everybody.
No.
But, you know, if I wake up like today and say, you know what? I'm not going to do nothing with the blog. I'm not going to do nothing with the video. I'm going to go for a run. I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to go to the store or whatever. I could do it. And that's where the liberation comes into play, is that I now can do what I want. If I want to, you know, I have post-its and I have post-its of what I'm going to do, either for a blog or for a video. And if you would see the post-its, you would say, oh my God, because it's like a chart. It's like a chart of my own.
Yeah.
And I could make a blog out of it, or I could make a video. Sometimes I choose to only make it a blog. Sometimes I'll make it a video. But if you've seen what it would look like, it's colors and it's, I'm not going to show it, but you know, but that's, what I'll do is I'll just pick one off, and then sometimes I'll say, nah, I'm not going to do that. I'll do this one. So, and that's where the liberation again comes into play, is that I could talk about what I want. I enjoy talking with other people. A lot of people question me and ask, well, how come you don't go on with this guy? And how come you don't film with this guy? First of all, is I don't know why they call it probation. I'm used to state parole. I always say parole, federal.
Right.
Parole, but it's called federal probation, right? So presently, I'm in the hands of the probation, the federal probation department. One of my stipulations is that I can't, you know, associate with known criminals or felons. And, you know, so I'm limited to who I could really collaborate with, you know. And that's why, and even let me just say that even if I probably right now, there's only a, I wouldn't say a handful, but there's a very few limited people that I will do something with, even if I didn't have the parole or probation that I'm on.
Yeah. Can you do me a favor? Can you clear up something for me? There are folks out there who think that federal prosecutors and the FBI are unhappy with you doing this and have told you to shut it down and things like that. You and I had a conversation about this one time, but if you feel comfortable talking about that, tell me what you're, when you hear that, what do you say?
No, that's absolutely not true. Were they, you have to understand, right?
I'm sure they weren't overjoyed. Let me put
not at all. But but to try to put it in perspective, what people need to understand is that I don't believe they didn't know how to deal with this, because especially with the blog, no one really has done that. Like they didn't have at the time. I was a witness with them or one of their witnesses, and now created a blog. So it caused them, there was like a little bit of hysteria going on, like, because, you know, like, what is he doing? What does he think he's doing?
A little agita is what you're talking about?
Yeah. I gave them a lot of agita. Right?
Yeah, I bet.
But no one has ever told me, you need to shut that down, or you can't write another story, or you need to get off of YouTube. No one has told me that. And I'm no longer one of their witnesses, obviously. And, you know, I could do what I want. But at that time, that's probably why either it was written the way it was written, whoever covered it, nobody ever told me from the government, any FBI agent, to shut it down, to stop doing the blog, not to go do a podcast. Nobody's ever done that.
Yeah. Nobody. Two last questions, and we'll call it a day, but it's been extremely interesting talking to you, and you've done a few of these before. So, but you and I've been talking over a few months here, and we decided to kind of talk about this. Just talk to me. You've testified at a couple of trials. How uncomfortable was that for you sitting there, or were you just there to do a job, the job you had at hand?
It's you know, I'm sure people don't believe it, but, you know, like I said, people could believe what they want. It's such a sickening feeling, you know. First of all, is I think for somebody who's never been to a trial themselves and sat at a defense table and never was convicted and never had people go up on a stand. And I've had somebody go up on it. I have a few people go up on a stand on us in the 89 case. It's a horrible feeling, right? Knowing that, now it's probably easy if somebody didn't go through that experience. You know, there's been people who testified and they've never been in that position. I can't speak for them, but being and going through a trial and knowing what it's like to be sitting at the defense table and having to go up. And what I say by having to go up is that you have no choice at that point. When you,
that's your deal. Yep.
The door of an FBI office, and you are now, you make a decision that you are going to cooperate. You have no choice. You're told to go. And, you know, I'll try to be specific. You know, you're told, by the way, I at one time was going for I was taking my plea. Well, I was being, no, I think I was being arraigned on the charges, because they have to, don't forget, you're talking about charges. And now if you talk about charges that you, or crimes that you were involved in, they can't not charge you. So you, you basically are talking yourself into an indictment.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
What happens is that you have to get arraigned. You have to get arrested, fingerprint. You have to go through the whole
process.
Gamut. Yeah. And then you have to go before a judge. When I'm standing before that judge is the first time that I'm learning about a trial, Bubsy Castelli's trial. I had no idea they were calling me in. And I remember when we walked out, I told one of the agents, I says, you know, what the F was that? Well, you know, and that's how you find out. Like, it's not like you're, you know, there was no heads up. And it wasn't like I was just walking into the trial, you know, I just heard it for the first time that way. And, you know, to answer your question, it's a sickening feeling, you know, and believe me, I have no love for Bubsy Castelli at all. You know, I have no love for him at all. And a lot of people think that that was like a payback for him. Not at all. Not, you know, he was the person that was involved with the person that I was involved in, unbeknown to me. Or well, I kind of found out near the end. But, you know, being a former defendant myself and sitting at a defense table and having your life, your freedom on the line, it's sickening to have to be in that position and have to walk and go up on the stand. It's just I don't think that anyone with any kind of conscience can say that, well, I'm just here to do a job. I'm just, you know, while I'm here, and this is what I'm doing. It's a sickening, nauseating feeling. And worse than that, they brought me to a trial with a member of the Genovese family, Frankie Giovinco. Frankie Giovinco was away with me in prison. I considered Frankie a friend. It's just like, not only from, not like my mother and myself discussed this because we knew his wife and kids. Like it was something that I did not want to go to Frankie Giovinco's trial. Believe me when I tell you. And I was praying, and I'm not kidding you, that he was going to take a plea. I really was hoping that he was going to take a plea.
Yeah.
And you know, I was told, well, maybe he'll plead and you won't have to go. I was not, it was not easy going to that trial. Yeah. And then he ultimately got convicted. You know, he didn't get a lot of time. Between Bubsy and him, they should have took pleas, because Bubsy, he should have took a plea. He would have been out in months. And I think Frankie would have probably only been maybe a year or so. I don't know why they should have took pleas.
Yeah.
The big trial, you know, this was the administration. I didn't have – what happened with me took place during the transition with the new administration. This was the – this these people represented the old administration. So, you know, once again, you know, you had all the guys. You had Maddie, Stevie. You had the young kid, Chris. I didn't know the black guy that was on trial with them, but it's not an easy thing to do, to walk in there and have to sit on a witness stand and talk about certain things. But you know, you it's like if you join the army and they put a rifle in your hand and they send you out to the field, you have no choice. You're like, you join the army, right? Well, I joined
the team.
The Lucchese family at one time, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not going to go into the whole thing. People have their opinions. I know what took place and I know exactly what took place.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my thing is, here's my loyalty. You know, I'm a Leo, right? Here's my loyalty. Here's 110% of my loyalty. Give it back to me. Don't burn me. And when that happens, all bets are off, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to give 110% here, if I now go and say, okay, I'm going to go, or actually I was forced to go, and I'm not going to get into that whole story, but so now I find myself in the office of FBI agents and the U.S. attorney, and I'm going to give my 110% there. If I'm told I have to do something, I have no choice. I have to do it. You have a choice. You could refuse, but then you're back to square one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's just, it's, you know, when I had to go to the big trial in Westchester, the Lucchese trial, the big trial, you go through a lot of emotions, and I wasn't in a good place because, you know, you don't want to, believe me when I tell you, and people may not believe this, I didn't want to go to any of these trials. Like if I had my choice, I would go, right? But that's not, you know, the government doesn't work that way. You know, we could help you this way, but you got to come to these trials. You know what I mean? That's part of, I think anybody that walked in, their main goal is, okay, well, we need you to come in and testify. Some people get there and wind up going. Some people testify at 60, 100 trials, you know, and if they want to. I didn't want, I went to three. I didn't even want to go to those three. And that's the God's honest truth.
Yeah.
Back to the Lucchese trial. I remember watching Tommaso Buscetta. They had the show about him, right? I think it was called Our Godfather. It's mostly put together videos by his family. It's very interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And his daughter had said something, and I think that my older daughter, probably my mother, kind of would be able to say the same. She said, I remember looking at my father, but it wasn't the father that I used to know. You could tell he was like, you're broken. You know, don't forget, it's, you know, when you're in that, when you're in the street and you are given that opportunity, that door's open for you to be inducted. And believe me when I tell you, it's a family choosing you. You don't just wake up and say, I'm going to get inducted and I'm going to go with this family. That's not the way that life works. Right? In the street, if you're in the street, is the highest honor. Right. And that's what that life is about. Right. If you're street, that's the highest honor. Right. So when you're now on the other side and you have to go to trials where people's freedom is at hand, you're broken. Unless you're a piece of garbage, then you're not. You're broken.
Yeah.
You're believe me when I tell you, it destroys you as a person. Mm. People may say, he's full of shit. And they could think what they want. I'm telling you, it destroys you as a person. And so I watched one of the daughters say something to that effect. But what they played when he went in to testify, and many of us have seen, you could see it on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
He had not only multiple defendants all around. They had to build the courtroom, right? They built the courtroom to hold all these bullpens with cages where they were screaming and cursing him.
Yeah.
You know, they let it go. You know, over there, you couldn't get away with that. And you know, a judge wouldn't let that happen, right?
Not for a second.
They couldn't control him over there. They were cursing him. Slice your throat. You know, they were doing all these things. So not only was he in that environment, but then what they didn't see was then they had their families, and he was basically testifying in front of a stadium of people. And you could tell he was nervous, you know, it's a nerve-wracking thing, right? Nobody get up on a witness stand and is relaxed and comfortable, and you know, it's a nerve-wracking situation to be in, right?
Yeah.
But I watched him and I said, my God, this guy, what he went through in front of all these people, and you know, and he had to do it. And I compared that to what I had to do. And that's really how I was able to just go in there and get up there. It's not easy.
John, listen, thanks for joining us. We had a nice hour packed with all kinds of stuff in there, including a little bit about your story and some interesting stories about the Philly guys. I appreciate you coming on the show. I know you're a busy guy. Good luck with the podcast and the blog. And keep on doing what you do and dodging the bullets from the critics. We all do that. But I do appreciate you giving us your time here. And thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome. And thank you for having me.
All right. That's Philly Prime for this week, folks. Thanks for listening. Pretty scintillating hour of conversation with John Panisi. John, thanks again for coming on. And folks, join us again next week. We'll have another podcast coming right at you. Join us on the Philly Prime Podcast.